From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A federal judge in Atlanta yesterday rejected a request for Georgia voters to use paper ballots in the November midterm elections. U.S. District Judge Amy Totenberg criticized election officials for failing to adequately address vulnerabilities in the state's electronic voting machines, but said she was concerned that switching to paper ballots under a tight deadline would increase voter frustration and disaffection. The request for an injunction was brought by voting rights and integrity groups, many of which are also focused on voter turnout. As NPR political reporter Asma Khalid has found, midterm elections have not drawn a majority of voters to the polls since the dawn of the 20th century. She came to Georgia to find out why, and she's now on assignment in Michigan, where we reached her on the line. Hello, Asma.
Hi.
So the U.S. has lower voter turnout than most developed countries. Now, how low are we talking?
We're talking pretty low. So in midterm elections, if you look at the past two election cycles as just kind of a handy metric, you're seeing elections where we had 40% turnout. So that's pretty low, right? You're talking about a situation in which a majority of people, roughly 60% of the population, stayed home. And then if you look further into that data at different minority groups or at young people, you're seeing even lower levels of turnout. So the 18 to 29-year-old population had about 20% turnout in the 2014 midterm.
So what is keeping people from turning out to vote, especially during midterms?
I would say, it's kind of twofold, right? I mean, there are a whole bunch of reasons when you ask people why they don't vote that come down to a choice factor. They'll say that they're too busy, that they don't have time, they don't care, they don't like their options, they don't feel that their vote matters. And all of those sort of reasons I would lump into the fact that these are people who could vote, but who are choosing not to vote. And then there's another category of people who legitimately do want to vote, but somehow get stuck along the way. Somehow the process, gets them caught up. And those are people who face a variety of voting barriers, right? And these are people that I will say are a lot harder to find because, oftentimes when I spoke with a number of voting rights organizations, they will say they know the people who try to go to vote and maybe their names were purged from the voting list, or people who will try to go for a variety of reasons and have registration problems because those are the people that contact their organizations. But they have a variety of reasons for believing that actually the real number of people who ultimately try to show up and have these registration problems but just walk away and say, forget it, I'm not going to bother with this, is substantially higher than that.
Well, you did speak with several people, one of whom, Raymond Taylor, he was at a barbershop here in Georgia, mm-hmm. who told you that he had voted but doesn't now. Let's hear him.
Well, the reason I don't vote on a national level around here because I don't think it's a red state, in other words. So I'm pretty sure it's like I could do my own mathematics and figure out what's going on and pretty much say, hey, this vote is not going to really matter for president.
So similar sentiment to other people that you heard, it doesn't matter. It's a red state. Who cares?
Yeah. And I think that that's a really interesting point, Virginia, because if you look at turnout across the country, you'll notice that some of the highest turnout rates were in states, if we look at the 2016 election, where the margin of victory was less than 5%. What I find really interesting, and I'm sure you all as Georgians probably even find this more interesting, is that the politics in Georgia is changing. But I feel like I'm talking to a lot of voters who don't feel that way. They still feel like the state is overwhelmingly a red state, that their vote doesn't matter. And I met Raymond in Middle Georgia in Houston County. And part of why I went to Houston County is, it's a fairly diverse place with a fairly sizable African-American population. And one of the things that I got just from walking around and talking to people is that the Black population there feels, to some degree, I should say, that they are largely, economically disenfranchised compared to some of the other populations. And so I spent a lot of time going around with the New Georgia Project, which is a group that is focused on boosting voter turnout, specifically minority voter turnout. And they were targeting people in affordable housing units and in mobile trailer home parks. And these are really, I would argue, people who are poor on the socioeconomic ladder. And when we look at voting data, historically we have seen that people who are on that lower rung of the socioeconomic ladder are more likely the people who are not going to show up, whether it's a presidential election or a midterm election year.
So here is one of the people that you spoke to there in Houston County, Dante Romph.
We tend to get looked over every time a presidency comes. You know, people still have the same issues with, you know, racial. You know, it gets real deep real fast. But that stuff seems to just continue no matter who's in office.
So, Dante Rumpf there in Houston County. You went literally just knocking on doors with the New Georgia Project?
We did. And, you know, Dante I met in this affordable housing unit. And what I thought was so interesting about him is, in some ways, his story to me is, it's so sad because you get the sense that he doesn't feel like voting actually will substantially change his life. But honestly, Virginia, that was not a particularly novel factor, right? I mean, we heard similar sentiments in other parts of the country. I spent some time in Las Vegas. I had colleagues who reported out in West Virginia as well as Texas. But it's a fairly common feeling, particularly among people who are, you know, either in minority groups or, you know, I would say are sort of on that lower rung of the socioeconomic ladder, where they feel like politicians don't care about them. And Dante told me this. I mean, he's 24 years old. He had never voted before. He has never registered to vote. He did register that day with the New Georgia Project. And I asked him, you know, are you planning on voting? He was kind of indifferent. He's like, I don't know. You know, he was not aware of who was running for governor this November. His mother, who was over his shoulder, was aware, and tried to, you know, sort of encourage him. But ultimately, he told me that there's this feeling of being overlooked. And I would argue that that is something we heard time and again. It's sort of a symbol of the broader class divide that we see in who votes and who doesn't vote.
I'm speaking with NPR political reporter Asma Khalid. She was here in Georgia. She's on a nationwide tour of the country, and she's looking at voters, how they vote, and why they don't vote. And Asma, here in Georgia, you looked, you mentioned voter purging or not being on the rolls. So tell us how voters are purged here in Georgia.
So there's a couple of really interesting things, I think, going on in Georgia. And I spoke with the Brennan Center, which had did a pretty comprehensive review of voter purges. And what they saw is that over time, they had seen a greater uptick in the percentage of people who were purged from, I believe it was 2014 through 2016, compared to the equivalent period of time if we look at 2006 through 2008, right? So if we look at the two-year span before a big presidential election. And we're talking about a substantially large number of people who were purged in the latter period. And I talked to them about places and states where they saw this happen, and they said one of the things where they noticed an uptick was in states that had been previously covered under the Voting Rights Act. And one of those jurisdictions, one of those states, is Georgia. And so, they, you know, I should preface this by saying a lot of states will clean up the voting rolls. This is something very routine, and it's something that's fairly necessary to remove people who've moved or died, just in order to keep your voting rolls accurate. What we have heard from some people is that at times, though, people are getting purged with such a sort of routine nature and without maybe the due diligence that's needed in order to ensure that people whose names should legitimately be on that list are there. And so I spent some time in Hancock County, which is about 100 miles east of Atlanta. And it's a really interesting story there because there is this law in the Georgia Code of Elections where if you don't believe so-and-so in your community legitimately lived at the address on file, you can challenge them individually. I can go up and say, you know, I don't think Joe Schmo lives in that house, and I formally put through this legal challenge to his voting eligibility. What happened in Hancock County is that these challenges were done in mass. And so you had a situation where about 17% of the voting population of this tiny town, Sparta, Georgia, was challenged. And this is fairly unheard of. You're talking about a situation where over 100 some people were challenged. It is a community in which about 3/4 of the population are African American. But what happened as a result then is a majority of the people whose names were removed from the voting rolls were African American. And so this then rose up the ranks and ended up going through to the Department of Justice. And this all happened in about 2015. Since then, there was a lawsuit, there was a legal challenge, and many of the people's names who were scrubbed from the voting rolls have been re-added to the list. I think we have a cut of tape of one gentleman I met. His name is Merritt Hubert. He's a young man, and honestly, what I did, Virginia, is I just found his name in the voting rolls, and I went to his door, and I knocked on it, and he was there. He was at the address on file, but he told me that they had tried to remove him saying that he did not live at the address on file, and this is the very address at which I found him at.
Here is just a short clip of Merritt Hubert.
Basically, I think it's a racism thing that they want whites to run the town. I think basically that's what it is.
Asma, that is Merritt Hubert speaking from Sparta near Milledgeville, Georgia. Asma, we're having your line is fading a little bit in and out.
I'd like
to know more about, you know, this law that allows neighbors to challenge another's eligibility. It must make for some very strange dynamics inside of that community.
It does. And so now what's happened is that, you know, because of the specifics of what happened in Hancock County, they have agreed through a lawsuit to change the way that they review these challenges. But one thing that I think is really interesting is I did speak with a woman who was on the Board of Elections. And she categorically denied that this had anything to do with race. She felt that the accusations of discrimination were blown out of proportion. I should specify she is a white member of the Board of Elections in this community that is overwhelmingly African American. But her argument was that their electors list was not current. And she said that part of what they did is they followed Georgia state law, that if a neighbor, if a citizen brings a challenge, they have the right, they have the obligation to review that challenge. And I asked her, how did you review that challenge? And she said, you know, we talked to neighbors. We were told that the people didn't live where they were saying they live. I think the thing that makes that tricky is one could also argue, well, that's hearsay. And I did ask her, you know, did you go to the property? Did you knock on their door? Because that's what I did with Merritt Hubert.
Right.
I looked up the address in the voter file and he was standing outside, you know, his house when I showed up there. And you could make the argument that there are ways to more legitimately perhaps vet where a person lives than just follow hearsay. What I will say is that this is not unique, though, to Hancock County. These challenges are part of Georgia state law. What I think was interesting is that usually they're used on a one-on-one basis. They're not used en masse.
En masse, as they were in Hancock. Asma, just a minute left. I'm wondering if voters that you spoke to talked about the Georgia governor's race, you know, if they've been stirred up by the candidates, either an appeal to, there's been great appeals to reach them and rouse voters. Had they responded?
You know, I did spend some time earlier in the year working specifically on the Georgia Democratic primary. What was interesting is this situation where I went down, I was specifically trying to hear from non-voters. And I will say, Virginia, a lot of these people are very disengaged from the political process. So some of them knew, I should say specifically about Stacey Abrams' race, because I did spend a lot of time with African-American voters. But what's interesting is many of them also were just unfamiliar with her name, including Dante Rump that we met earlier. You know, he didn't know that if she won, she would be the first African-American woman ever to be the governor of Georgia. And I do think this speaks to sort of the uphill battle of just trying to engage a population that at this point has felt relatively disenfranchised for a while.
Asma Khalid, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
NPR political reporter Asma Khalid, she has been in Georgia and around the country reporting on low voter turnout and other turnout issues. Now, just ahead, one chef's consuming love for collard greens. But first, I'm going to try a most remarkable diet, bugs. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A bug in your food is not usually considered a good thing, but what if they are there on purpose? The United Nations says about 2 billion people on Earth include insects in their daily diet. University of Georgia entomology professor Marianne Shockley wants to find ways to make insects a sustainable food source for humans and feed for farmers all over the world. I visited her in Athens and asked about her first bug encounter.
Very young age at probably a church camp, and you're dared by your, you know, peers to eat an earthworm or something. And I didn't flinch. I thought it It tasted like dirt because that's where it came from. So I think I've always been more adventurous with you know, eating and just trying new things. And so I guess from a very early age, I've always been curious.
The Eating Insects Conference that you had in Athens, I was reading about it, and it said that there are researchers from all over the world and coming and bringing their experience. Like, what is the current research on eating insects?
Okay. Well, I can certainly share a program with you, and I think it's very telling. Just at this conference, there were philosophers. There were people from food chemistry and nutrition. There were people from animal and dairy science departments, poultry science departments, entomology, business school, marketing, psychology, anthropology. Really, there's so much space in this in this field, and it's kind of two-tiered. We have insects for food, so consumption for you and I as humans, but we also have insects for feed, and so there is a lot of people really interested in using insects for waste management or for organic waste streams, food streams, and things like that. So lots of different minds together really kind of looking at these big questions.
Philosophers?
Ethics of eating insects. And it's something that, you know, we have to be aware of. It needs to be on our radar. Insects are invertebrates, and so we're not really on PETA's radar or anything like that. When we do research with insects, we don't necessarily have to have, you know, animal subjects review boards or whatnot like our vertebrate colleagues do if they're working with mice or rabbits or something. So we're in a little bit of a different sphere as researchers, but we do still need to be aware of it. And if we're trying to direct our narrative, let's just say towards vegans, who are vegans for a very specific reason of, let's just say, animal cruelty. There are many reasons that people are vegans, of course. Then we need to have a good answer to that question. You know, are insects raised ethically? Are they harvested ethically? Are they processed ethically? Do they feel pain? We don't know a lot of those answers to those questions, especially when you start dealing, you know, with the humanity side of insects and how they think and feel. So once again, just need to be aware and keep our minds open.
Why do you think the movement for eating insects has grown in recent years? Is it indeed a lack of supply for food supply, cost of food supply? Why has it become a thing?
I'd say it's two-tiered. So in 2013, the United Nations and the Food Aid Organization released this huge report about alternative protein sources. And the preemptus behind that particular season was many of our RUTFs, or ready-for-use therapeutic foods that we use in food aid programs, they're basically protein bars that a lot of times, or some sort of a porridge or something, and the proteins are plant proteins, most specifically peanut proteins. And if something happens to that crop, let's just say Georgia is, you know, a very high producer of peanuts, if we have a bad summer and we don't have the crop that needs to go into all of these different food aid programs around the world, then there's a bottleneck, and now we're having starvation issues there's so many options. Why are we limiting ourselves to creating something that could collapse on us? And so really it's the expansion of what's in our toolbox. We're not wanting converts. We really just want, you know, like you have Meatless Monday, maybe we can have like Buggy Thursday.
But I think for a lot of people, there are probably some psychological or social or cultural hurdles to get over. So how do you walk people through that process?
A lot of it is education. And people are very, food is emotional. And food is very, you know, familial and cultural, so you have to kind of keep all of that kind of at the front of your thoughts when you're talking to people. Or I don't try to convince people to eat insects. I don't feel that that's my role. I'm here to educate about insects as beautiful creatures, and let people know that they are edible if and when they choose to try.
What are some of the insects that we get here in Georgia or in the Southeast that would be good for eating?
So we have several large cricket farms here in Georgia that are supporting this industry, which is very, very exciting. There's been a shift, or not a shift, but I guess an addition with a lot of farms that are rearing for the animal industry for their pets and their reptiles and things, that have put in a food grade line. So crickets are readily available and a Georgia product. We want to, you know, Georgia grown is important, as are mealworms. There are several local mealworm farms. And so those would probably be the two most commonly consumed.
What are the tastiest bugs?
I tried so many new bugs this week for the first time. I although I've eaten bugs a lot over many years, probably five total have been in my repertoire. So this week, what my new favorite bug is, are ants. And they have such a citrusy, lemony, limey flavor. Just eat them straight, just a pop of just yummy goodness.
So eat them straight? You just take an ant and...
Eat them straight. So the way Chef Joseph Yoon from Brooklyn Bugs prepared it this week was as a garnish. So instead of adding that squeeze of lemon or lime to the dishes he was preparing, he topped them with the ants.
Whole ants, or would he grind them up? So it's not just the idea of eating ants, but you actually see them floating on top of your... I don't know.
And that's kind of an interesting line that we're walking here in the U.S. There are some people who are very much so into their food systems and want ownership and want to know the food chain and be involved with it, that probably would be very comfortable eating a whole insect, knowing it's a whole insect. Others understand the importance, don't really want to see the whole insect. But if you kind of look at society as a whole, especially, you know, westernized society, a lot of people don't want to eat a whole fish either, with eyeballs and mouth and whatnot, tails and fins on. They want the fillet.
Well, in addition to your work on edible insects, you've done a lot of work, especially bringing students to places across the world. You yourself have been to China, you've been to the Galapagos, Ecuador, Costa Rica, studying insects. Tell me a little bit about studying insects in the rainforest. What's that process like?
It's very exciting. We usually, you know, start pretty early. The thing about insects, they're around all the time and all the times of the day, but you find different insects based on the time that you're out. So I love being in nature. I love hiking. And it really is just, you know, 10 to 20 days of hike after hike, observation after observation, talking about the different insects, really looking at how they're fitting into their natural environment, doing photography, maybe doing some art sketches, maybe doing some research projects, asking specific questions in that space. It's just exciting. And once it gets dark, it's a whole different ball game. The big bugs come out at night, so it's really exciting. And the students, you know, feel the enthusiasm that I naturally have, and it's really rewarding to see them at the end of the trip just love insects as much as I do.
You started this study abroad program. I'm wondering, in the years that you've been doing it, have you ever watched a student sort of cross over from, you know, a little freaked out or a little skittish about bugs to really embracing the insect study?
Oh, absolutely. I'd say every year I have at least one or two that are there because they're interested but have really don't have a personal connection. And so they're a little more hesitant, kind of standing towards the back. We have these wonderful night collecting sheets where you'll have millions of bugs swarming around you. They may have, you know, a whole face net on or something. And, you know, after two or three nights of that, or certainly after a couple of weeks of being there, those fears are just to the side.
What is the greatest discovery you've ever made, either in breed or, you know, the most dangerous insect?
I would probably say the favorite insect that I ever personally collected was a peanut-headed bug, and it was from Costa Rica, and it literally looks exactly as what you would imagine. And it's one of those, they're very elusive. You stay up late, you put up traps, you search year after year. And finally, one year, I found one on my boot at the dining hall over lunch. So it was one of those bittersweet, I had to do nothing, it came to me, and I finally got to observe one.
Okay, Dr. Marianne Shockley, what have you got for us today?
All right, I have an assortment of delicious and nutritious edible insects, ranging from whole grasshoppers, these are chapulines from Oaxaca, Mexico. They're made with a wonderful chili and garlic and lime, which gives them just a fantastic flavor. Another different type of whole insect. These are whole crickets from Intima Farms in Canada. So if you're wanting to do something with the whole roasted cricket, this would be your base. So a lot of what happens is once you have the ground into a powder, you can start incorporating it into a lot of these different ideas. So we've got several different types of protein bars that simply have ground powdered crickets incorporated.
So it's used like a flour kind of
thing? Not necessarily a flour, because that has an underlying assumption there's a leavening agent. Mm-hmm. So it's just protein powder. I usually add about a tablespoon to whatever I'm creating. So if it's muffins, brownies, my pizza dough, my biscuits, my marinara, whatever. That's enough that it doesn't change the chemistry or the consistency or the texture of what I'm already preparing.
And chips.
Just your tortilla chips. Everyone loves tortilla chips. But once again, you can have just your plain corn tortilla chips or feel good about having some extra protein.
You said you incorporate this into your cooking. Do you
eat? I do. So my kids probably eat way too many bugs. My college kids as well as my personal family. But it's just kind of fun and they're always around.
Cricket protein bars. There's a banana flavor and an apple cinnamon. I think I'm going to go for the chapul, which seems, it's peanut butter and chocolate, and the first couple ingredients are organic coconut nectar, peanut butter, date. Blah, blah, blah. Crickets are way down there. I'm going to eat this now. It looks like your average protein bar. Dense. I don't taste a lot of peanut butter, but I did it.
Do you taste crickets at all?
I don't know what crickets are.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is UGA entomology professor Marian Shockley. She was a primary organizer of the Eating Insects Athens 2018 conference. And those critter snacks? Actually, pretty good. We'd like to know, have you ever eaten an insect? Or would you? Call us at 404-500-9457 or leave us a comment on Facebook or on Twitter. And now for a change of scale, if you'll pardon the pun. South Georgia waterways are home to a lot of alligators, but there's plenty we do not know about these big reptiles. GPB reporter Emily Jones reports from the Okefenokee Swamp.
I need to see how many babies there are. So I'm going to just try and count how many there are.
We're both kneeling at the edge of the walkway, counting and snapping pictures when...
There she is. Okay, get on this side. Sorry.
What was that?
That's her.
Mama Gator Sally is lurking under the boardwalk, making sure we humans don't mess with her kids.
Emily worked alongside researchers who are studying alligators' place in the ecosystem and joins us now from Savannah. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Virginia.
Safely away from gators right now?
Yes, there are no alligators in the studio.
Well, so what was going on in your mind with a moment that we just heard when you came into contact with the mama gator, who hissed, by the way?
It was a little bit nerve-wracking. The researcher that I was with, Kristen Zemitis, she did say that there was a good chance that gator is named Sally, and that there was a good chance that Sally might be lurking nearby. She might be under the walkway that we were standing on because she had her eggs had literally just hatched hours before. So I knew she might be nearby, but I didn't even know that alligators made noise. So that was a little bit, we were kind of leaning over the edge trying to take some pictures and stuff. And it was a moment of fear. I think when
I can
that
imagine.
Happened, for sure.
What were the researchers actually studying?
So they've put these satellite trackers onto Sally and two other alligators that are in the Okefenokee Swamp. So they're tracking their movements, and you can actually follow them online yourself as well. And they're just trying to learn more about what the alligators are doing, where they're going, and kind of figure out what that might mean. And just kind of collect some more concrete data on them about how they live their lives and how old they get and just all sorts of information about alligators that we don't really have a lot of concrete data on yet.
Well, here's Kristen Zemitis from UGA describing one gator that she encountered.
Out in the swamp, they referred to him as crazy. He's massive. He's underwater right now. He's a little hard to see, but he's the widest alligator I've ever seen. Probably about 12 and a half feet, if we had to guess.
Crazy the gator sounds like a very large specimen. So,
yes.
Who is he?
So he is an alligator, actually, that they have captured, and that's in an enclosure in Okefenokee Swamp Park. There's a couple gators you can see who are in enclosures, and then most of them are out in the wild. But they had to sort of lure him into an enclosure and kind of close him off from the rest of the alligators because he was so big and so aggressive that he was actually creating some problems. And they think that some of that might be just because it is a park that's popular with tourists. You know, they're very careful about about the alligators, but an alligator can get used to humans when there's humans walking around all the time. So they think that maybe is a factor. And he was just interfering with the other alligators trying to live their lives and do their alligator things. So they felt that it would be safer for everyone if Crazy was closed in a container, or not a container, an enclosed area where he's got kind of a fence around him. He's got water. They feed him plenty. He's very happy. Just hanging out in his own closed off section of the swamp.
DPB reporter Emily Jones, also host of Morning Edition there out of Savannah, with the latest word on alligators. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Sure thing.
Now, you can hear more of her reporting on Georgia's gators at gpbnews.org. And you can also see and follow some of the Twitter accounts assigned to these alligators, which give us a pretty good picture of their everyday life. Now, just ahead, one Atlanta chef on his love for collard greens. But first, exploring the connection between Southern food and football. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Heads up on the show that we're working on for tomorrow. The Pew Research Center found a decline in religious sentiment across the country, and especially a rise of religiously unaffiliated young adults. So what are churches here in the Bible Belt doing to reach young people? And how about you? Have you left the church? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457. You can share your thoughts on Twitter or on our OST Facebook group. And join us for the conversation, of course, tomorrow at 9 a.m. But now, football and food, two mighty markers of Southern identity. True South is a new series about how they intersect.
The South is old and kudzu-tangled. South is new and strip mall. South is an idea, long debated. This is a conversation about home, an invitation to the table, stacked high with spare ribs and collards, with cornbread and tortillas.
True South debuts tonight on the SEC Network, and John T. Edge of the Southern Foodways Alliance is host of the show and joins us on the line from Oxford, Mississippi. John T., great to speak with you.
You too, Virginia.
Well, I'm trying to imagine that pitch meeting with SEC executives for a travel show about food for the College Football Network. How did that go?
It was over tacos at a little place down the street from my house. And I think I had the Cordero, and I think Rosalind Durant, who has shepherded this through the network on behalf of SEC, I think she had Picadillo. All that to say, we began this conversation talking about how food resonates and how food is changing in the American South, and we wanted to build a show around tensions between what the South was and what the South is becoming. We wanted to build a show based on these kind of two restaurants in each town that would have a conversation with each other, and we as a viewer, me as the host, gets to listen in on that conversation. The idea that we did it for a sports network or are doing it for a sports network was kind of a natural. There isn't as much football. I hope your listeners don't come looking for a lot of football. Football shows up in this show in the same way it shows up in everyday life in the South. It's seemingly everywhere, but it's not a focal point for us. The South is the focal point, and the changing dynamic South is the focal point.
Yeah, as we heard in that trailer, and I haven't seen the show because this is apparently as closely guarded secret as Nick Saban's playbook, I'm guessing. But in that trailer, you say the South is an idea long debated. So what kinds of ideas about the South are you exploring on the show?
The first episode focuses on Birmingham, Alabama, and focuses on the Greek community of Birmingham. And we begin the story with Sam Kasmas, who immigrated from Greece in 1884 to Birmingham. And we look at the way in which Greek immigrants transformed the city of Birmingham. And we try to bring that into focus today, and we look at the way that immigrants are impacting and transforming cities like Birmingham and the whole of the South. So we look at our history, and we look at the transformative impact of immigrants upon the South in a city like Birmingham. And then in the next episode, we move to Athens, Georgia, where we focus on a Peruvian restaurant in a little community north of Athens called Norwood. Across the street is a barbecue joint called Scott's Barbecue.
Well, John T., let me stop you there because we've got a clip here of the owner of Pollería Polario, Pablo, right here on True South in Athens, Georgia.
Do you claim the South? Are you a Southerner?
I think the South claims me. I can't leave this place. I mean, it's part of me. The landscape, the people, the places, they are part of me now.
That's from True South, the owner there of Pollería Pablo in Athens, Georgia. Now, that question of who identifies as a Southern, you know, he said, the South claims me, is a big part of what we're exploring on this show.
Yeah.
How are you getting to that?
Well, the person we just heard is Beto Mendoza, who does work with immigrant communities. They're just north of Athens. And just before that clip, you would have heard Beto tell me about what he sees when he regards Norwood. And he told me that he sees black people and brown people and white people. He sees them all as hard workers, and he sees that bond, that hard labor, that striving to make it in the modern South is what they have in common. And in this show, that show focused on Athens, we see one immigrant community and one African-American community. And we see over the course of the show what they have in common. And we answer that question about, is the South a place ever divided, or is the South a place knitting itself together? And in a place like Norwood, I see a South knitting itself together. And people like Beto, who's a community organizer there, Beto Mendoza, are a big part of that. We follow him, and we listen to his logic for what the South might become.
And the four places featured in this first season, Shreveport, Birmingham, Nashville, Athens. One meal for you that stands out, John T. Edge.
Our last episode, the fourth in this run, it focuses on Shreveport. And there's a restaurant there I dearly love called Lucky Palace. It's owned by a gentleman named Quan Lim. Quan Lim is a Malaysian immigrant running a Chinese restaurant where the two gentlemen in the rear of the restaurant working the oversized woks are Mexican-Americans, and where they turn out these amazing wok fried T-bones and beautiful roasted duck. And Quan Lim has built a wine list that is as good as any restaurant might aspire to. All this done in the back of a rent-by-the-week motel hard by the interstate in Bossier City across the river from Shreveport. He is a beautiful person, and it's a great story.
John T. Edge, host of True South, that's debuting tonight at 7 o'clock on the SEC Network. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
And now we head into the kitchen for our new series, Main Ingredient, showcasing one essential Southern food. Part of the inspiration for this series is Chef Todd Richards' cookbook, Soul. So we asked him to start us off. And for Chef Richards, the choice was obvious. It's one he wears on his sleeve, or at least forearm.
It's not rare for chefs to have food as part of our art form.
Where Popeye sports an anchor tattoo, Todd Richards shows his love for a Southern staple.
Collard greens are to me the king of greens. They stand strong. They grow in wintertime. They grow in spring as well. But they just stand strong. They're broad shoulders. They have a regal quality about them because as, you know, the outer leaves get broader, the inner ones get so small and tender. and they're like the linchpin of all things. You know, you have the salty ham, you have the sweet potatoes, you have the creamy mac and cheese, but collard greens is that vegetable that just absorbs all those things and make them even more delicious.
And he can go on about this food that Southerners have depended on for generations, not so much in the North.
Yeah, we'll do some. We'll cook up some bacon next.
Todd, I grew up in New England, and I did not
too many collard greens in New England, I'm sure.
I actually didn't know that garlic didn't come in a shaker until I was about 18.
Okay.
So my mom was not a great cook, and I'm going to tell you that we had never had collard greens on the table.
Well, that's an American tragedy in the making.
How did you learn how to make collard greens?
I learned how to make collard greens from my grandmother. And in the neighborhood, there's many grandmothers, so there's always a different versions of it. My grandmother was just ham hock, onions, vinegar, salt, pepper, collard greens that she washed in the sink. Washed them three times, regardless how clean they were. They always washed three times. On the third time, some of that water would go into the pot, because if you understand collard greens and washing them, that the more water it gets agitated, the more alive they come. So you don't want to leave all that wash water just there if it's really, really clean. So we'll use that as well. And the agitation process too, you see the chlorophyll starting to seep out in the water, and you just never want to lose that essence, according to my grandmother. Next door was same ingredients with the addition of bacon fat and different kinds of seasoning salts. So it could have been Lowry seasoning salt, being from Chicago, that makes sense. Onion powder, garlic powder, those things were incorporated as well. As I got older, smoked turkey replaced ham hocks. As I got older, my grandmother didn't cook large collard greens. She cooked smaller collard greens, just sauteing them with a little bit of bacon, onion, apple cider vinegar, and sea salt. I always say that my grandmother was using sea salt when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. You know, she was probably more avant-garde than most chefs, you know, at that time.
Chef Richards has looked over many pots of greens since then. I visited his sleek, spotless home kitchen, where he put together a breakfast sandwich, fried egg, bacon, and the star of today's show, collard greens.
Nothing like an egg hitting the pan. Use the leaves, of course, for it. And it's really the perfect sandwich for me. I'm not a big lettuce person, but I love greens on there because it gives texture and body, and also gives a good amount of flavor to the dish as well.
So when you're cooking it, what is that? You know, like on top of greens, there's like this foamy stuff that comes up, and it always looks, I don't know, slightly kind of dingy.
Well, what happens is that the greens are breaking down, and typically, if you cook them very rapidly, you will have that rise to the top. We usually just skim the top of it away. But also, if you're using fat, what happens is that attaches to the fat, and as the pot cools down, you know, the temperature of the pot is less at the top than it is at the bottom. So then the fat is pulling all that impurity, what we consider impurity, to the top, and we just skim it and take it off. Just like if you're making chicken stock. If you want to do a clarified chicken stock, you would do the same exact process.
Mm-hmm. Part of the thing that you're known for is taking these traditional Southern ingredients like collard greens and using them in ways that people wouldn't think of. When you were a chef in these hoity-toity restaurants, when you were sort of, you know, woodshedding, learning how to do this stuff, mm-hmm. was there any part of you that felt like, ugh, can't talk about collard greens because that's, you know, poor people food or something?
Well, my first job in a hotel, my first day, a chef asked me, what was my purpose of being in the kitchen? And was I going to just make soul food, as in fried chicken, mac and cheese, collard greens, anything of the sort? As he was saying that it was not as good as the cuisine that we're preparing there at the restaurant, which was French food. And probably through the first 10 years of my career, I felt that soul food was not good enough. based off of that one, here I am in the most luxurious hotel in Atlanta, that this chef is asking me, am I going to just cook basically black food? And it's not going to be good enough to be a chef in this hotel. And later on in my career, what I started to really understand is that from the technique standpoint, that the technique wasn't quite different from French food to the same way that my grandmother or my mother or my dad was cooking food, or the lady next door to us was cooking food. In a sense, my dad used to fill the sink with water, put spices in there, put the chickens in there before he smoked them. He would sit them in all this brine while the ribs are going. So they would sit there for, you know, 6-7 hours, you know, getting ready for a barbecue. So my dad was brining chicken, you know, when I was a kid. And he would only use one side of the smoker for chicken because it was, you know, it was a little bit hotter than the other side. So the technique wasn't different than anyone else that I was doing. My mom, the way she made catfish, that only could be fried at 325 degrees. She would never stray away from that. And she would measure out each ingredient. It was more than just a pinch of this and a pinch of that. She was actually measuring how my great aunt, who makes cakes, who still at 94 bakes, you know, 5-6 cakes a week, coconut cake, pound cake, 30-day cake. So she is a prolific baker at 94. So her cooking or pastry techniques are no different than anyone else. So that's when the tide really changes. I feel like, well, you know, you're not teaching me anything new because my parents already taught me this as a kid. And the requirement that it had to be delicious to go on a table was even a bigger part of the conversation. So you weren't teaching me any new standards because they were already inherited part of me growing up as a kid. Mm-hmm.
So did you put a little paprika or something on that egg? Looks like it's got a little color.
Yes, it has a little bit of cayenne pepper.
Oh, cayenne pepper. So you're loading us up with spicy stuff.
Yeah, but it's really great.
What are you going to do with that sandwich?
I'm going to cut it in half and give you guys some. While I sip on a glass of champagne, of course.
As I devour my delicious breakfast sandwich, Chef Richards finishes his breakfast bubbly. It's a daily ritual that he began after a series of family tragedies years ago. Like tending the sturdy collard greens in his garden, sipping champagne in the morning gives him balance.
You can be miserable with all the listenings of instant news, Instagram, instant things, or you can just take a little bit of time for yourself each and every day and be fortunate that someone loves you as much as they do, and that you can always find a way to love yourself regardless of any situation. And that's how I do it. I just have a glass of champagne and go out to the garden, and I just really start my day in the most positive way I know how.
That's Atlanta-based chef and James Beard Award nominee Todd Richards. He's author of the cookbook Soul. If you visit gppnews.org, you can find traditional recipes for collard greens along with that amazing breakfast sandwich. And that's it for today, but we do want to hear from you. What is your favorite essential Southern ingredient? You can leave us a message at 404-9457. You can reach us on Twitter or on our new Facebook group. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our technical director, and Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.